All right, we're at Woodley Farm, somewhere in the middle of California, I think. You know what? So much road's been going by, I'm not even sure where we are. Do you know what town we're near?
No, I'm not sure, but yeah, we should be somewhere in the middle of California, yeah.
Not too far from Redding, I think. I remember the names of the towns as we were going there, but now I've forgotten.
All right. Hours and hours from Redding, we have to be.
Oh, okay. All right. And I can't remember the name. Oroville, is that right? It's not that important. So anyway, we started talking somehow about Yellow Jackets, and then you said you'd never heard the story, but you've listened to my podcast, and so it's like, oh, well then I guess that I've never told the story on a podcast before. I thought I had, but I guess I haven't. And so it's good to have somebody listening to podcasts who will bring these things up so I can get them conveyed.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you haven't told this story about the Yellow Jackets, but until recently I didn't know what a Yellow Jacket was. So it just might be that you have talked about this before, but I just didn't
make the connection.
Yes.
Because I was talking in that crazy English talk. Not the standard Norwegian.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
That is correct. You have been speaking English.
So, we were over at Del Artemis Farm, Marina and Robert's place, and then, boy, there was a dead mouse there, and the Yellow Jackets were grooving on that dead mouse. And then later they thought it would be awesome to groove on what we were eating, and so that's when we moved inside. But, most Yellow Jackets are meat eaters. Of course, there's like gobs of species of them. Some of them are more meat eaters than others. I don't think it's a universal fact that they're all meat eaters. But I have a story. It was from when I was on Mount Spokane. There were two different years where the powers that be, because it was on three sides, the land is surrounded by forest land. And so on two different years, while I was there, they were having some bug trouble, and so they thought that the thing to do would be to bring in these meat-eating Yellow Jackets. And they brought in billions of them. And so at my place, the ground was covered. There'd be about 100 Yellow Jackets per square foot. And they would hover about an inch off of the ground. And so all the ground everywhere was alive with Yellow Jackets. So the first thing I did is that I went and got some Yellow Jacket traps and put them around. They'd fill up in about a half an hour to an hour. And then I'd put them in the freezer, and they'd die. And we had all the chickens were totally loose then. They were totally free range, truly free range. And so what I'd do is I'd go out there, and then I'd say, here, chick, 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 which is the magic word I had trained them to believe in, was when the goodies were coming. And they'd all stampede over to where I was and then wait to see what I might throw upon the ground for them. And so then I threw Yellow Jackets on, and they gobbled them up before they ever looked at them. They just, vacuum, vroom, gone. And I did that about two or three times before they started to realize this thing that they were eating that they found to be so delicious was the exact same thing that was already hovering about an inch off of the ground. So within two or three days, all the rest of the neighborhood was covered with those Yellow Jackets still, except for our place near the house where the chickens were. There wasn't one to be found. So they were just gobbling them up. Then, part two, is I got this idea of, hell, that's chicken feed in the wild there. If only I had an automatic way of collecting this chicken feed. So I took a 55-gallon drum, and I poked a hole out of the side, and I took the lid off, and I put a piece of clear plastic that I had on the roof. I think it was actually not plastic. I think it was the that ribbed fiberglass stuff, and I rigged it up so that if a Yellow Jacket got into the barrel, the Yellow Jacket wouldn't be able to get out through the roof. But I wanted there to be light inside. And I also wanted it to be able to have some air escape kind of stuff going on. And then I poked a hole in one side near the top and a matching hole on the opposite side near the top. And on the one side, that's where I had a screw on. I welded on a screw on cap, and that's where I would put the bait. And I found the best bait was pretty much any kind of meat, but cat food was amazing. Like the wet cat food that came in a teeny tiny can for 30 cents, and it's like so. On the other side, I put one of those yellow jacket trap, one way yellow jacket things, so that that worked so well in the yellow jacket traps. And these are those kind of like yellow cones with lots of little holes in them, kind of a thing. And but I never finished that last little bit, and so the whole contraption was 90% complete. But I figured what I'd do is I would take this and go put it out in a field somewhere, or you know, where there's lots and lots of yellow jackets, and then let the barrel just kind of fill up with yellow jackets, and then the heat inside the barrel would turn all those yellow jackets into yellow jacket jerky, which I could then feed back to the chickens in the wintertime. So that was my devious plot, which I never completed. I think that last year was the year that I left that farm, but that I was making that. So there's that yellow jacket story. And then I know that another one that I had was about, and this is like a silly, not too useful story really, but I was living in a house in college, and one day I went outside, and I was growing a bunch of strawberries, and what I would do is I'd go out in the mornings and pick five or six strawberries and sit and eat strawberries while sitting on the porch. And but this one side of the house, when I went out, I was barefoot, and as I was about to put my foot outside, I stopped because everything was different. The porch was black, and it's not supposed to be black, and it was moving, which it's not supposed to do. It was like writhing, and so I closed the door, backed away. Kind of went and found another door on the other side of the house, which was normal, and then walked around the house to look at what was going on at the front of the house. And it was covered with millions upon millions of flying ants. Just this big, solid mass, probably a good inch or two thick, all over the front of the house. Not really sure what all was going on there, but that was wild, man. So that was... Just as a so there's my flying ant story. Not as interesting, I'm sure, as the yellow jacket story.
No, you didn't feed them to the chickens?
I didn't have chickens then. Although, you know, so I wasn't thinking like pretty much what I was thinking like, are they going to go away? And they did. They did. Like later that morning, they all just left. They were all gone. There was like five left. You know, everybody else went away. It was a little bizarre. So anyway, there's a couple of bug stories for you. Now let's talk about what we've been experiencing on this trip. So we're about a week into it. I think it was exactly a week ago that we hit the road.
Yeah. Yes. Now it's Saturday, and we left Saturday morning from Woodinville. Yeah.
Yeah, and we're gonna go see Steve Heckeroth next, and maybe he'll let us drive his cool tractors and swim in his natural swimming pool. But, all right, so yesterday we started off at Del Artemis Farm, and then we went to which farm?
Chaffin Family Orchards.
And we ended up here at Woodleaf Farm. And so we stayed the night at Woodleaf, and now we're getting ready to head out. And so at Chaffin, then I saw something. I mean, the cool thing, they have 2,000 acres. And they had like a little one of those short buses, one of the an old school bus that's the short style with the big handicap thing in it. They'd painted it up all funky, and they put us in this bus and they drove us all over the place. And they do have a lot of orchards. They have olive orchards. So we're in a part of California that's warm enough to have olives. And they had lots of olive, and you know, of course, they were orchards, which you know, kind of pained me to see in a big way. But they're trying to like move towards something that's a little bit more polyculture-esque, and we talked about that a couple of different times, like what polyculture might look like when you transform an orchard towards polyculture. And I thought we saw a really good example of a paddock shift system for chickens, and they were also doing it for goats. I didn't see, were there, there were, they had some cattle and sheep in one area. Oh, and we got to pick an orange off of a tree. That was pretty cool. I've never had an orange right off of a tree before.
Me neither.
Yeah. And, but I liked, so they had a paddock and they had a lot of chickens in this paddock, but the grounds didn't seem destroyed. And it's like, oh, they've been, you know, we moved them here a couple of days ago. And it's like they had more time to go before it was time to move them again. But in each paddock, they had, livestock guardian dogs in the paddock with the animals. No matter what kind of animals they were running. And I was thinking that's the way it's supposed to be. That's just smart. And they used a lot of electronet. I liked his technique for how he would get into an electronet area. He would just hold his foot up like 3 feet off the ground and then just push the fence over, and then we would walk in, and then he would step off the fence. I thought that was like, you know, that was pretty well choreographed there. That was pretty neat. I'm always like, oh, I'm going to go disconnect the fence and, you know, we're going to just make sure to connect it up when we leave and things like that. And it's like, no, this fence stays hot the whole time. So much faster. Pretty smart. So what did you think of what we saw?
I thought this was nothing short of awesome. It made me very happy to see, I guess you can call it a permaculture orchard. They are trying, they have some interplanting and they want to do more. They are moving towards a polyculture, and yeah, actually it kind of is, because the way they plant their trees in groups, so it's not one huge area with the same trees, but they have a lot of different things. The list there is Bing cherries, apricots, peaches, nectarines, figs, Asian pears, Duke avocados, green olives, pomegranates, persimmons, mandarins, oranges, lemons, grapefruits. And then, in addition, they have the rotational grazing to keep the system healthy, and in addition, make more money out of the same acreage. So they have grass-fed beef, grass-fed lamb, grass-fed goat, pasture-raised chickens, pasture-raised eggs, grass-fed beef jerky. Yeah, awesome.
I like the story about the kid. The kid that was 5 years old started raising chickens there. Like, he's the son of somebody there. And he got all this ideas, like, he's going to raise chickens. And then somewhere around the age 7, he's kind of like thinking, you know what, these adults, they're doing it all wrong. And so then he started changing his system to be contrary to what the adults were advising him to do. And it turns out that the kid at the age of 7 was right. And so now he's got like this whole chicken breeding operation that he's created. So he's got this collection of chicken tractors, and he moves them a couple of times a day. So that way the chickens aren't just standing around in their own shit. And, but most importantly, in each tractor, there's going to be this particular kind of rooster and the right kinds of hens. And then when he collects the eggs, he pops them right into an incubator, and he's cranking out mountains of chickens. And it's like these very rare breeds. And he's this rare breed breeder, and he gets more money for those chicks than he gets for conventional chicks. And he's selling them. I mean, so basically, oh, and then there was like something else too about the sheep. Like, let's change the goat to the sheep or something like that.
The amazing guy who had Chris something told about this story where the kid had come over to him and suggested to phase out the meat production and instead go for wool production. And the natural adult reaction was to tell the kid why he's wrong, but Chris went in and looked at the numbers, and it turned out the kid was right.
Well, they let the kid do it. Like, ah, kids, that's so cute. You know, let the kids. And then it sounded like in the end, the adults are kind of like, shit. This kid's like making far more money than we were. This kid's like, man, he's really got it figured out. So I imagine that what happened was is that they started off thinking, there's just really no money in wool. I mean, it's just hobbyists that do this. And so there's just nothing there. and the kid pushed, and the kid like developed the market or something. And so now, the wool that they're getting has huge value. And not only that, but normally they were saying something like, normally they kill the males, or they butcher the males, because it's like, the females produce wool and babies, and the males can produce only wool. And so it's like, no, but in this particular case though, it's like, no, it turns out there's a big market. There's a lot of people that want to have a male that's castrated, that's just never going to have babies or anything, or be interested in the whole baby thing, and instead just eats and makes wool on and on, year after year after year, just keeps cranking out the wool. And so there's a lot of people that just want to have one of these animals around just for that. And so they're selling these things for like $500 a pop. So it's really rather impressive what this, and now the boy is 10, and he's got quite a large scale thing that he's doing. It's just, little boy genius, I guess. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was, it's a lot of cool stuff is happening in that place, and especially I like the way they are constantly trying to push it further, even more permaculture stuff in there.
So then now we're here at Woodleaf, and it's like one thing is that we got to eat some peaches, and wow, those were good peaches. Very, very delicious, extra spectacular, juicy, delicious peaches. And I think there's hardly anything better than a delicious peach. I mean, even a huckleberry. I mean, it's like, huckleberries are really good and everything, especially in the pie. I think I'd rather have a huckleberry pie than a peach pie any day. But boy, a fresh peach right off the tree, that's amazing. And I thought of something too as I was walking around, and I'm wanting to give this fella a lot of my advice, Carl. Wanted to give Carl advice. And of course, Helen Attow was here before me. And so Helen Attow has already given him a ton of advice. And I've already told Carl I disagree with a lot of what the advice was that Helen gave him. But, he gets to pick and choose what he thinks is the way he's going to go. But this reminds me of my software engineering days when I would show up to a company and they would say, oh, this old piece of software that we got here is total crap. We need a total rewrite. We need to start over from scratch and stuff like that. And I think most software engineers, that's what they do. I mean, basically they see a piece of art and they're like, I can make a better piece of art. And so I want to make a better one of those and, of course, get paid along the way to do it. And my rule of thumb in software engineering is that if you've got a piece of software in your business that is already making you money, that by definition is a good piece of software. I don't care how many bugs it has. The fact that it's making money, because I think in the software industry, for every piece of software that you can find that works, there's 50 of them that don't. And so here, at Woodleaf, and as well as at Chaffin, both of those designs currently have an income stream. And they're supporting, and the Chaffin, I think, that's like 100 years old. They've been doing that for 100 years there.
Yeah, something like that. And Woodleaf Farm is also a long time organic.
Right. And we're only visiting things that are organic or better. I don't think we're going to visit, if we have anything on the schedule that's anything less than organic, I think we need to hack it off the schedule now. But I'm pretty sure we don't have anything. Everything's going to be organic or better. But the key is that both of these farms, they currently have an income stream, an income, and people are making a living doing this. And so, by definition, that's a functioning system. That's a good system. That's good farming. And then it's like, okay, now let's talk about, are there rooms for optimization? Can we set aside 2% of the land and do some experimenting to see if we can get more income per acre or better flavor, or can we cut expenses dramatically? And so then this seems to be with Carl. A lot of the stuff that I'm thinking about. And so he showed us, now you're saying you said, oh, it's a good example at Chaffin of a permaculture orchard. And that just sends a chill down my spine. Cause it's like, that's an oxymoron. Those are two words that don't go together, orchard and permaculture.
Well, if you take this place as an example, here you see a lot of monocropping. it's the same trees as far as your eye can see. Well, it's not. It's only 8 acres that is grown, but they have the same type of trees all the way, without the polyculture and intercropping that we saw at Chaffin. What we see here is also lack of implemented permaculture techniques, but they have been organic for a long time, and there is a willingness to do permaculture. Carl showed us the area that is dedicated to a food forest, and he has been talking about how he wants to do more permaculture at this place. So
at both sides, they're talking about how they want to do more permaculture.
Yeah, but Chaffin is way, way ahead of Woodleaf at this point. You see the difference?
I do agree with that, because if nothing else, Chaffin's worked in paddock shift systems, which I believe are going to really dramatically improve everything for what they're doing. Whereas it sounds like there were chickens here at Woodleaf last year, and then they stopped doing it because it's, you know, the workload. And it's just two people here. And so working this, and it's like, you know, well, you got to go to market. You got to take all your stuff to market and sell it. And then, you know, now the chickens are kind of on their own. It might be, you know, a day until you get back. And so that was too long. But I think that, yeah, there's ways to come up with systems to mitigate that. And clearly at Chaffin, they were doing some of that. But, so I want to express, and granted, I think there's going to be a lot of people in the permaculture world that are going to feel as you seem to feel, which is that having a permaculture orchard is okay. And granted, we saw an area that was going to be sporting soon the label food forest.
And here at Woodleaf.
Here at Woodleaf. Yeah. And so he was saying this is going to be a food forest. And I was looking at that and I was thinking, still too monocroppy for me to call it a food forest, but I could also see some people, you know, basically saying orchard, and well, we don't like the word orchard, so we're going to call it food forest, but it's still exactly the same. All we did was change the label on it.
Yeah, but they are supposed to take out trees and take other stuff in, so what we saw was basically just the designated area for the future food forest.
So in both cases, I tried to save my suggestions until the end because I feel like I want to see everything before I piss people off. And so at this one of the things he says, we're going to take this row of cherries here, because that's what they're doing here. They got like a row of cherries next to like a row of apricots next to a row of something else. And so everything's got a row, and usually everything in the row is the exact same variety. Because when they go and they box it up and everything, that they want to say, oh, this is the so-and-so variety of this peach, you know. So that's their technique. That's how they roll. And so what I was suggesting is, so we're going to take out this row of cherries. And so what I said is, like, I'd like to make a suggestion. This isn't, like, 100% what I would call permaculture, but it's on the road, and, like, right now, I sense that you're like you're excited about permaculture, and at the same time you fear permaculture. You're worried that if you try some permaculture, you might end up making less income, and it, you know, the margins are already a bit thin. And so I suggested, take this row of cherries, but instead of taking out all the trees, take out 9 out of 10 trees out of this row, and then so you're going to leave 1 out of 10 cherry trees to become bigger cherry trees. Then, in between the cherry trees, put in 9 other species. And so, and it'll be this mix. But, like, every other species has to be either a taproot plant or a nitrogen-fixing plant. And so now, out of this row, which, you know, previously was all fruit-bearing species, you might have, like, because some of your taprooted species will be food-bearing, and some of your nitrogen fixers will be food-bearing. But you might have 10% of them are not food-bearing, maybe. Well, you know, depending on what you choose to plant in there. And so now you're going to be getting a variety of crops off of this one row. But I predict that life will be easier, that it will reduce your workload, both for irrigation, pest control. Well, dominantly irrigation and fertilization. I expressed some concern over his fertilizer. He was bringing in compost from offsite, and I told him, I warned him about persistent herbicides, and he didn't seem to put a lot of weight in my warning. And so hopefully he won't get bit by that one. It seems like most people are okay with getting off-site composts and things like that until the day comes that all their stuff dies, and then they won't use it ever again. It's kind of like that's kind of a hard lesson to learn. So I hope he doesn't have to learn that lesson. Anyway, at Chasen Farms, I was suggesting something similar, because they've got their blocks of monoculture. They've got a block of orchard. So this block here is all olive trees of the same variety. And this block here is all oranges of the same variety. And this block here is all, so they were doing a lot of that.
Yeah, they had a lot of that as well, yeah.
Yeah, so here it's more like a row. Here we have an entire row of a variety. And then over at Chasen, it was more like blocks. But And in both cases too, they're all pruned up lollipop style, as opposed to branches all the way to the ground. I would like to see, the branches all the way to the ground. In fact, I suggested it to Carl, that plant some stuff from seed and let it keep the branches that are next to the ground just as an experiment. You don't have to go and, rip out all your existing trees and do what I'm suggesting. I'm saying, set aside a spot as an experiment and see how it does. And he's like, but then it's not going to get enough air, and those lower branches will be a vector for funguses and stuff. And so it's like, Carl, just try it and see the funguses for yourself. So anyway, what have I left out? What do you want to make sure we get into this podcast about what we saw?
Well, I feel we have said it all. Obviously not all, but the Chasen orchard was awesome in the way that they have implemented so much permaculture, and they want to do even more, and that makes me happy to see.
Yeah, they seem to be. When we talked to them, when I threw my ideas their way, they were like drinking it in and like, give me more, and then some of the suggestions I made. They said, we had the same idea. We're going to do that already. So I love to hear the validation of our ideas. And so they were very, whereas Carl was kind of like, I don't know. I got something that's kind of working now. I'm not sure. So it's kind of like, I don't know, kind of real difference of taking it in. We'll see how both play out. It seems like Chaffin's going to be far more excited with the things that I suggested. Which I think one of the things I suggested is that between every other row of trees, get some texture to the landscape, including hugelkultur, plant lots of shrubs, and that when you start getting a lot of shrubs and other species mixed in the understory, then when the people come in to harvest, say, stomp on the shrubs all you want. And they'll basically make paths for each tree that work for that tree. And then, those paths will persist. And then they'll be able to still harvest from each tree despite there being a lot of shrubs in between. So, and they said that's what we're already doing. It's amazing that you said that because that's our current plan. And they were also, we're working on building up a lot of intern habitat, which I think is really brilliant. And they are getting started in some very fascinating things with, agro-tourism. So they've got some people that want to come and live on the farm for a week and help on the farm and pay them to be there. And so they're already building up all of the infrastructure to be able to facilitate some of that, which just sounds amazing and brilliant and awesome. And they've already hosted like camps, and they're saying like, it's kind of freaky weird how we host a few camps each year. And like the income we get from hosting these camps is like now like one of our best income streams for the whole farm. And so I'm really liking that. I like the idea that a farm that's doing so good is able to infect the brains of others, and help get this kind of knowledge spread out. What else we got? Anything?
Nothing on the list.
All right. If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permuse.com, where we talk about polyculture, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.